Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Zoom. Zoom is used by millions to connect face-to-face, across town or around the world. Zoom ties together all of your unified communication tools into one easy platform for video conferencing, phone calls, group chat, webinars, and conference rooms. Zoom is how business gets done. Visit Zoom online to set up your free account today. Meet happy with Zoom.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 17th of December, these are our main stories. The French official in charge of pension reforms, which have triggered nationwide strikes, resigns. The estranged wife of Zimbabwe's vice president appears in court, charged with attempting to murder him. And the hospital operating entirely below ground in Syria. Also in this podcast...
Not only is does that lava keep on burning, but the chemical nature of it continues to burn and through the entire thickness of the skin, into the fat, into the muscle.
The doctors in New Zealand trying to treat unique injuries following last week's volcanic eruption. We begin this podcast in Mexico, where the authorities say at least 50 bodies have been found buried in mass graves at a farm outside the western city of Guadalajara. Forensic experts say they've been able to establish the identities of more than a dozen people. All of them are on Mexico's list of missing people. Ana Gabriela Rojas of BBC Mundo told me about the discoveries.
The authorities in the state of Jalisco say that the victims are likely to have been killed by criminal gangs fighting for control of drug routes. We know they started the exhumation 3 weeks ago, when they got reports from human remains. During the excavation, they realized that they were more and more. This is a sadly trend in Jalisco state. This year alone, 7 mass graves have been discovered, one of them with more than 120 human body parts belonging to about 50 people.
Yeah, nearly 2,500 murders reported between January and November. But these mass graves were only found 3 weeks ago. Why are we only being told about this discovery now?
Most of the times in these cases, authorities take time to talk about the discovery because of a few reasons, including the security of forensic teams during the exhumations, but also because many times they don't know how many victims those human parts belong. Actually, I have spoken to forensic workers, and they told me that is precisely the biggest challenge for identifying the bodies. Most of the times, they only found parts of them, since the bodies are in really bad conditions. They were chopped or burned.
And briefly, one particular drug cartel under suspicion here.
Well, not really in this case. I mean, we know there is a war of cartels in that state. Jalisco is the base of Jalisco Nueva Generación, one of the most powerful cartels in Mexico, and they fight for the plaza with the cartel de Sinaloa that was headed by the infamous Chapo Guzmán, now in the U.S. prison. Also, the arrest of Caro Quintero last year, he was the boss of Cartel de Guadalajara, who created a fight power within that criminal organization, according to the experts.
Ana Gabriela Rojas in Mexico City. Now to Zimbabwe, where the estranged wife of the vice president, Constantino Chiwenga, has appeared in court in Harare, charged with attempting to murder him. Mary Chiwenga is accused of trying to kill General Constantino Chiwenga when he was in hospital in South Africa. Here's our Africa correspondent, Andrew Harding.
It started as a simple but dramatic case of alleged corruption. The estranged wife of Zimbabwe's vice president arrested and accused of money laundering and fraud. The case was presented as proof of the country's new commitment to clean governance after the misrule of the Mugabe era. But then came the news that Mary Chiwenga was also being charged with trying to kill her husband, the army general who overthrew Robert Mugabe. He alleged that she tried to prevent him getting medical treatment in South Africa and had even pulled an intravenous drip out of his arm in hospital. Regardless of the specific details, in the eyes of many, this case now fits a more familiar pattern. the pattern of a country where corrupt elites accuse each other of assassination plots and poisonings, and where the police and courts are used to settle scores. A country, in other words, where precious little seems to have changed since the days of Robert Mugabe. That sense is compounded by Zimbabwe's deepening economic crisis, the country gripped by hyperinflation, crippling power shortages and mass hunger.
Andrew Harding. In Syria, those who remained during the civil war have had to learn to adapt, and that includes moving some operations underground where they can't be bombed. One such place is a local hospital, and a new film is telling its story, featuring the female doctor who runs it. This report by our correspondent, Michael Rossi.
All seems quiet. The silence before the storm. Those are the sounds of rockets being fired on eastern Al-Ghouta, near the Syrian capital, Damascus. Under siege by the Syrian army for more than 5 years from 2013, with thousands killed, those bombing sounds are what open a remarkable new documentary film called The Cave. The Cave is directed by Syrian film director Feras Fayad, and it tells the story of an underground hospital in eastern Al-Ghouta.
During the revolution in Syria, I decide to search about the people who have a good side, not the bad, the thing that make you feel what we are looking for as a Syrian, what we are searching for.
In his search for those doing good in the midst of civil war, Feras, through a filmmaker friend, came across footage of a young female doctor, Dr. Amani Balour. He learnt that she worked at The Cave, the name given to the underground hospital in eastern Ghouta, opened as a safe place to treat patients.
When I discover more stories about Dr. Amani and this hospital, I feel like this is a model of democracy. This is represent the situation in Syria and dream of Syria. Syria, what we like.
The film tells the story of the key figures in the hospital. There's Dr. Amani, hospital manager, Dr. Salim, the surgeon, Samaher, a nurse, and Dr. Alla, another young female doctor. And for Dr. Amani, the difficulties she encountered as a woman, a single, unmarried woman, are clearly shown on camera. In one scene, a man comes in asking for medicine for his wife and makes clear his feelings that a woman shouldn't be running a hospital, as far as he's concerned.
Actually, it's very frustrating and it makes me angry too many times.
Dr. Ramani.
Some men in my country, they refused me just because I'm a woman. I'm a doctor and I can do as other doctors can because I was in this hospital from the beginning. I know the needs of this hospital. I have a plan to develop the hospital, to protect it, to make tunnels. And I did that.
Some of the most difficult moments for Dr. Amani and her team were dealing with malnourished or injured children.
I remember a child lost his arm because of bombing. And he asked me when he woke up, he said, "Where's my arm? You are a doctor, you cut my arm. Why you cut it? You can do nothing for them, but can you imagine what I felt when they said that?"
Dr. Amani ending that report by Michael Rossi. It's now a week since the deadly volcanic eruption on White Island off the coast of New Zealand. 18 people died in the eruption. Attention is now focusing on the survivors and the horrific burn injuries they sustained. My colleague Dan Damon spoke to burns expert Jeremy Rawlins. He's the president of the Australian and New Zealand Burn Association and described the unique injuries caused by lava.
These patients have sustained very, very deep injuries in keeping with lava, which of course gets to very, very high temperatures. In combination with that, they're seeing quite an extraordinary appearance, which looks very much like a chemical burn as well, associated with these burn injuries. And then on top of that, and I think something that most of us hadn't appreciated, was that these patients have experienced quite significant blast or explosive type of injuries as well. So there's on top of their burn injuries, quite significant explosive and blast injuries to these patients as well. So really, really difficult injuries to treat.
I'm guessing, based on my pure ignorance, that burns from boiling water or flame are bad enough, but the lava, it sticks.
Absolutely, and it keeps on burning. And what we're seeing is that not only does that lava keep on burning, but the chemical nature of it continues to burn and cause very, very deep injuries through the entire thickness of the skin, into the fat, into the muscle, with obviously devastating consequences. So it's a very, very unique set of circumstances that my colleagues are looking after.
We talk about percentages, don't we? The percentage of a body that is burned and what that does to survivability. Well, how do you judge that?
So obviously the larger the percentage body surface area, the worse the prognosis. And of course, in keeping with that, the more difficult it is to treat these patients surgically. Some of the patients have got burns that are in excess of 30, 40, 50, some patients with 70% skin loss. And that in itself presents a huge challenge, irrespective of whether it's a bushfire, which of course is common this time of year in Australia and New Zealand, but even more so because of the deep nature of these injuries and the complicating factors of these blast injuries as well. So really, really big burns that will take many weeks and indeed months to reconstruct and put back together again.
Jeremy Rawlins, the president of the Australian and New Zealand Burn Association. Still to come in this podcast, the students living on the front line in Afghanistan and trying to get an education in the midst of conflict.
When I leave my house in the morning, I first greet the Taliban. Then, when I cross to the government side, I greet the soldiers.
President Emmanuel Macron's attempts to reform the French pension system have been dealt a blow after the official in charge of overseeing the changes resigned. Jean-Paul Delevoye was accused of a conflict of interest. Hugh Schofield reports.
Jean-Paul Delevoye was France's Mr. Pension Reform. From early last year, he'd conducted an exhaustive analysis for President Macron about the different options for change, and having presented his recommendations, he was brought into the cabinet in September. Unfortunately, in joining the government, he was required to fill out a declaration of interests, and this, it's now clear, he failed to do properly. In all, he held 13 consultancy posts, mostly unpaid, but some in areas like the insurance business or the SNCF rail company, which could be seen as having a link with pension reform.
Hugh Schofield. The continuing violence in Afghanistan has forced a pause to the renewed peace talks between the United States and the Taliban. With fighting raging across the country, we're going to bring you a snapshot of how one community is coping. BBC's Orlia Atrafi has had exclusive access to a school in Kapisa province, just north of Kabul, which is on the front line.
The start of the day at Ghazi Usman Khan Secondary School in Tagab district. But it's no ordinary bell. It's actually an empty shell from a tank dating from the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And the school's 1,200 pupils, aged 7 to 19, and its teachers lead no ordinary lives. Before the lessons begin each day, the army, who have a base next door, drive an armoured Humvee vehicle into the school yard to protect the staff and pupils. It's a boys' school. In this conservative area, many girls don't go to school. And those who do, go to just two schools, which are a bit further away from the fighting, but still not completely safe.
Number four. The boy is 10. Alek Dangarde, he is a 10 boy.
An English lesson at the school. But even when the students are in the classrooms, they are not safe. The walls are pockmarked with bullet holes and shrapnel damage, with the Taliban firing rockets at the government troops who respond with tank fire. The head teacher is Muhammad Ayub Safi.
Our students come here from across the area. And while no one targets them on purpose, they do get caught in the crossfire. Over the last 20 years, around 50 students and 12 teachers have been killed or injured.
Wherever I look, I see dangers and explosions. Oh God, so many funerals. Wherever I look, I see graveyards. I'm lost as we keep dying. Oh, burning flame of my juvenile heart. Tell me who will die today.
Year 11 pupil Zarmal Danish wrote this poem after one of his friends was killed by a stray bullet.
Our friend Qasim Ibrahimi was killed. It was a very painful moment. We began hating everything about the school and decided not to come here anymore. But our parents and siblings persuaded us to come back.
Zarmal's father is Bakhtullah Amiri.
Despite all the dangers, I send my son to school so that he studies and gains an education and achieves something, because my generation have been deprived of knowledge and culture. I don't want my son to suffer the same fate.
Several of Zarmal's classmates, including Niaz Muhammad, live on the Taliban side of the front line.
When I leave my house in the morning, I first greet the Taliban. Then, when I cross to the government side, I greet the soldiers. Sometimes they start fighting each other and we get caught in the crossfire.
The BBC's Olia Atrafi reporting. Zambia's President Edgar Lungu has asked the US to withdraw its ambassador after the diplomat criticised the jailing of two gay men. Last month, Ambassador Daniel Foote said he was horrified when a judge sentenced the men to 15 years in prison for being in a relationship. Zambia's Foreign Minister Joseph Mlangi then said the criticism was tantamount to questioning the Zambian constitution. Our correspondent Rob Wilson has been speaking with Mr. Mlangi.
Zambia has constitutional-led democracy, which has three arms of governance. And each one of these has got an autonomous status from each other. All decisions made by the court are according to Zambian constitution. Ambassador Foote went out to condemn the judiciary. As an ambassador, there is a way through which he can actually present his demarche to the government if he's aggrieved. We have a cordial relationship with the United States of America. We do not expect to have an ambassador credited to Zambia to have tantrums. Having a press briefing condemning the judiciary, there are channels through which he could have done that. Even our diplomat in Washington cannot just go and start condemning why did judiciary determine this matter in this way. We cannot do that.
Ambassador Foote himself says that his job is merely to promote what he calls the interests, values and ideals of the United States, and that's what he was doing in this case. Is he not entitled, as the ambassador, to take a view on controversial issues?
The laws in Zambia are that gayism is not allowed. Not until the Zambian people suggest that they would want to practice it. But as for now, the law stipulates that it cannot be practiced. So we find it folly for an ambassador who is accredited to Zambia, who knows the do's and don'ts of the laws in Zambia, to have a press briefing condemning the judiciary.
One other thing he said in his statement after this spat developed was that the current government of Zambia, he says, wants foreign diplomats to be compliant with open pocketbooks and closed mouths. He is saying that you only want diplomats there who are going to bring their foreign aid money and not criticise the government. Is that what you want?
Not at all. But one thing I can assure you is we are not going to have a donkey and a rider aid in Zambia. I will tell you that when he was aware that I was going to make a press briefing, he sent me a note to say the American government is helping 1 million people in Zambia with HIV drugs, and all those are voters. Don't you think that is tantamount to quid pro quo?
You think he was threatening you?
Basically, that's what it means. If he says all those are voters, meaning he would influence them to vote against us because he's the one that is providing the drugs. I've never heard a diplomat behaving in such a manner, more especially from somebody who is coming from a kind of country like the United States.
Zambia's Foreign Minister Joseph Malanji. They are hailed as a modern-day menace to the environment, but far from being an invention of modern coffee chains, disposable cups, it seems, have in fact been with us for thousands of years. Here in London, the British Museum is showing one that it says is more than 3,500 years old, dating from the Minoan period on the island of Crete around 1700 to 1600 BC. The conical drinking vessel was apparently designed to be thrown away after a single use. Oliver Conway has been to see it.
The Rubbish and Us display here at the British Museum charts our changing relationship with waste. In front of me, a case with two cups in it. Alongside me, curator Julia Farley. Julia, describe the two cups, please.
Well, one is a waxed paper cup from Air India that was made in about 1991. And I think that's something that will look quite familiar to a lot of our visitors. But next to it is another kind of disposable cup. But this one is more than 3,500 years old. And it was made by the Minoans on Crete.
It looks a bit like a cross between a bowl and a cup, perhaps like one of those ones that you get chai out of in India, made of clay. How do we know it was disposable?
So there are a number of ways that we know that this was probably made to be used only once. We find large dumps of little cups like this at the Minoan palaces like Knossos. It's not very well made, so you can see little finger impressions where it's been turned on the potter's wheel. It's slightly wonky. The wire they've used to take it off the wheel has cut into it at the bottom, leaving it a little bit damaged, and it's only very lightly fired. They were capable of making very, very elaborate and beautiful pottery, so there's a reason why they haven't spent very much time on this one. At this time, we have obviously rich leaders living in these palaces, but they're also throwing parties, throwing feasts for people from the wider community to come and gather together, maybe see special events. And we think that what's happening is that at these events, people are given an individual serving, probably of wine, in one of these little cups, very roughly made. And the idea is they drink from that, and then afterwards the cup is thrown away. And that's why we find these very large rubbish dumps of cups like this one.
Given people have been throwing away things for thousands of years, is it any wonder the world is in the state it's in at the moment?
Yes, people have always produced rubbish. We're tool-using animals, tools don't last forever. It's inevitable that we will produce waste, so it's not about making individuals feel guilty about that fact. But what we need to think about is scale. The kind of scales of society that we see even on Minoan Crete are completely different to what we have today. I've talked about there being thousands of those Minoan cups known, and there are, but today, across the world, humans are making more than 300 billion disposable paper cups every year.
Julia Farley, thank you. But it's not only ancient rubbish here. The display also features a basket woven from the discarded plastic found on the beaches of Guam, highlighting the way that people today are fighting back against the tide of waste.
Don't museums have unique acoustics? Oliver Conway reporting from the British Museum, and the Minoan Cup goes on display later this week. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.